Welcome to Daniel, our 63rd lesson. I've entitled it The Spiritual War Explored in the Lion's Den. Let's look at a couple of past slides from our previous lesson. We want to understand that there is this underlying spiritual battle that is ongoing. And it's not warfare as we would understand it. If you think for a moment, what is really the purpose of warfare as man conducts it? Now, we can say it's diplomacy by another methodology. It is the another means of trying to impose one's will upon another. And whole books have been written about that topic alone. And really, without any great conclusions being drawn. But when we come down to it, when you ask the person in the street, what is the purpose of war? And then we have to go back to Patton's speech. And I want to paraphrase it from the movie Patton with George C. Scott, because I think it condenses to its most basic fundamental elements the purpose of man's warfare. And that is to make the other guy die for his country, his society, that which he believes in, rather than yourself. Yes, we give great rewards to those who have died for their country. Then we forget those people almost immediately. Unless we trot them out once a year in some empty ceremony that is quickly forgotten in a summer picnic. But in point of fact, these people died not for freedom, not for country, not for any of that. They died for time. Time for that country, that society, that empire to continue to do what they were going to do. So all you do is buy a little bit of time. If we were to go back to all those people in World War II, Americans, who died for freedom, and show them the America of today, they had thought we'd become Nazi Germany. Checkpoints there, train stations and airport terminals and being frisked and searched, and they wouldn't recognize America. They said, this is not, they would never have enlisted if they had known we were going to be this. And not just us, but almost every other country in the world has jumped on the bandwagon because it gives power to the central government, which is really one of the hallmarks of Satan. Now, while it may appear that I'm going down a rabbit trail and I'm off topic, I'm really not. Because what we're talking about here is angelic warfare. And what would that look like? Because, see, when we go into battle as people, my job is to shoot at you until you die. And by dying, I mean your body drops and becomes lifeless and is not revivable and begins to decay. You're out of it permanently. Because we can only sense in the empirical realm, in this physical realm. And the flesh was made for this physical realm. And everything in this physical realm is passing away. This is a disposable creation. Peter says it's going to melt with the fervent heat. The writer of Hebrews says that Christ will take this creation off and roll it up like a garment. This is not ever going to last. It was never designed to last. As great and fantastic as the heavens are, they are disposable. They are a work of wonderment of God. And to our minds, since we're only seeing in the empirical, that which is visible realm, they seem self-sustaining. But I bet you, if we could take to heart Hebrews 11:3, that which is visible is built upon that which is not visible, we'd see that it takes a whole lot of effort to keep this disposable creation going properly. And on top of that, man introduced sin into it, which is kind of like pulling the pin on a grenade. Only rather than 5 seconds, it's 5,000 years or 50,000 years or whatever God has determined it to be. But according to Romans 8, this whole creation is groaning and running down. Now, it's not running down to a flatline entropy like Big Bang Theory would teach, but it's running down until God says, I'm not going to support it anymore. And then, whoo, in a flash, a blazing brilliance of melting heat, this creation is unleashed, unhinged, and ceases to exist in its present form. Then I think God takes this material that he borrowed out of nothing, created out of nothing, and reassembles it so that it now will be eternal, self-perpetuating. Once again, another rabbit trail? No, because when we talk about people, we should be talking about souls. And souls are eternal once created. If I shoot you and you drop dead, I only separate you, your soul, from your body, which is not you. It was only your vehicle. But you are contained in your soul, not in your brain, in your soul. The brain is kind of like a very almost magical switchboard between that which is not seen and that which is seen. Now, if you think about that for a moment, you'll probably overload. So think about that at another time. But it's really important because we're talking about spiritual battles. We're talking about angelic spiritual battles. So that's really the only kind there are. And angels are not trying to kill angels, or demons, as we'll call the fallen angels, because they can't. It is literally an impossibility. God himself cannot cause his creations to not exist. Because they have part of his nature in them, and his nature is eternal. He cannot make himself not exist either. So, are there things God cannot do? Yep, there are. And we've talked about them in the past in James chapter 1. He cannot be tempted by evil, neither does he tempt anyone with evil, because he cannot do evil. Thus, there are things God cannot do. And so we have this sense of this underlying spiritual battle. And the reason that I'm throwing these concepts out is I want you to think and conceptualize how very different this is from our current understanding. And from the understanding of Lost Man in particular. You look at the computer games and the movies and the poetry and the stories and everything, and angels are destroying angels and demons, and they're going out of existence. And that is just, to borrow an old phrase of ridiculousness, that is just pure poppycock. That is just lunacy. They do not cease to exist. That is the whole reason there is a lake of fire, to contain them, because they cannot not exist. But they can't exist in the new creation, which is holy, totally cleansed, totally without sin. But it takes up all the available visible or whatever space, for lack of a better conceptual term. Thus, the only place that is reserved for them and to contain them is in the lake of fire. They wanted a world, they wanted a universe without God. They kind of got that-ish. They wanted it without Christ, and they're going to get that part. They wanted it without God, well, they're not going to get that part. Because you can't have anything without God. And thus they suffer the wrath of God for rejecting the Christ, his monogenos son, who died for them, didn't die for the demons, did for mankind. But I want you to understand that this little section of Daniel is the only glimpse, pretty much, that we get of this. There is a reference in Revelation 12 where Michael and the angels come together and battle with Satan and his demons and throw him out of heaven and throw them down to the earth. Now, we can debate when that happened, but that's really not part of this particular lesson. But we do know they can be contained. They can be controlled. We see this in Job chapter 1 and 2. Now, Satan has to operate within the bounds that God allows. Therefore, it's not a war against God in which God is ever going to lose, because, I don't know, God. That is not Satan's purpose. Satan wants God to contradict himself. And thus be proved unrighteous and unable to judge Satan to go to the lake of fire. That, you know, when you come right down to it, that is the ultimate motivator for Satan is self. Now, you can purdy that up any way you want to, and he does. But when it comes right down to it, that's his sentence, and that's where he does not want to go. And he doesn't care how many you he tramps over. Because he figures there's enough, then God will contradict himself. God will violate his nature. God will sin. The only problem is he couldn't get Christ to sin, who's in the flesh, empowered by the Spirit, and guided by the Father. So he's not going to have a good time. And he knows he's not going to have a good time. And he's read the Bible more times than you have, because once again, he was there at the beginning. And so he's been there since, through multiple generations of mankind. We all come into this picture just brand new, spanking ignorant. And we have to learn. And we might have 1,000 years to learn, might have 500 years to learn, we might have 80 years to learn. And that's it. And then what we know experientially dies with us. There's some that we can pass on. There's some that we can write down. But by and large, the upcoming generation doesn't want to understand what has gone on before. They want to learn for themselves, which is like saying, you know, I want to be dumb. And I'm so proud that I want to be dumb that I'm going to write songs about it, make stories about it, and I'm going to be dumb. So that when I get smart, everyone will be impressed with me. Except each of the demons is 10,000 years old. Let's just say mankind has, since Adam, it's been 10,000 years. And you're going to take your 80 years worth of experience, 50 of which are wasted, and you're going to go into combat and do what? I mean, that idea is so ludicrous. I'm surprised they're just not in the throes of belly laughing throughout the universe, all these demons, mankind bragging about he's going to control you. And they just, oh, see. And they have to go through this, you know, this cycle all the time. So what is the purpose? What is the spiritual warfare? Well, it's about restraint. Because sin has no restraint. There are angels, or fallen angels, demons that have been so out of control, they've had to be chained in the abyssos, in the center of the earth. They, upon release, they would be so destructive. That's why they were there. And what Daniel has shown us is that not only is there this quote-unquote generalized restraining at work, but it's parceled down to every major empire or every country or every society or every ethnic group. In fact, Satan is great at regimentation. Because remember, that's how you, when everything wants to be out of control, you have to forcibly regimented to impose control from the top down. See, God doesn't have to do that. Satan has to do that. He has no other means to be able to do that. So demonic forces are at work trying to unrestrain man's culture to eliminate God's influence in the gospel. And the angelic forces are opposing them to maintain semblance of control according to God's plan. Satan is there to disrupt God's plan, and the angelic forces are there being guided by God's plan, empowered by the Spirit. And this whole thing is non-empirical, therefore it is absolutely undetectable to man. If we could see the spiritual realm, even around us in our presence, it would probably be very crowded. And we would suddenly be, wow, very embarrassed to do anything, knowing just how visible we were to those that we didn't have a clue we were visible to. And see, this is the problem with going only on empiricism. It's a fallacy. It's a trap. Now, history is written. And we know this because we have the Bible. And it's essentially, the Bible is a history book from the very beginning. And it denotes the totality of history in broad aspects. And both in this creation and into the next. And we discuss this, well, what does this do about choice? And historically, people have either chosen mechanistic predetermination. In other words, I'm just an automaton. I'm just a slave. Nothing I can do, and it's not right, and it's not fair. And God's evil for making me sin. That's theodicy. The other choice is we're free. We can choose anything. Now, neither viewpoint is found in the scriptures. There are advocates on both sides, and it's just hilarious, but it's just not there. Mechanistic determinism is not in the Bible. Well, how about Romans 9? Or how about when God said, I hardened Pharaoh? He didn't have no choice. See, that's no, that's you know, when you come down to it, this literal, rigid hermeneutical understanding is really lack of understanding. See, man only thinks in three dimensions in time. That's it. Height, length, breadth, and the z-axis, time pushing us through. And that's all our brains are wired for. And be honest, most people have trouble with the three dimensions. You put them in a car where it's just height and width and depth. You have two dimensions. Well, three if you count of going down the road across time. And they still have trouble not killing themselves then. Now you add a third dimension to that. like fighter pilots and stuff, they fight in three dimensions and time simultaneously. And it takes a long time of training and special aptitude to be able to do that. Well, God probably did not limit this creation to three dimensions. That which is seen is certainly appears limited to three dimensions plus time. But how about the unseen? We have not a clue how many factors there are at work simultaneously, acting upon us and around us and on every level. And if we have trouble operating on two levels, how would we fare if we were aware of all the multiplicity of factors? I think that little brain computer would lock right up. Eyes roll up from the back of the head and boom. You're done. Yet, this is what God understands. And not just for one person, every single person, every single object. See, we think of the earth going around the sun, but as it's going around the sun is going around something, and the galaxy is going around at its own orbit, and yet the whole galaxy is moving through space on its own. That Earth really isn't in a flat orbit. It's a spiral. But it's such a multidimensional, complex choreography of movement occurring simultaneously that'd be impossible to predict. Be impossible to know for us. But for God, it's a blink of an eye. He got it. Because he can think on infinite levels like that. Now, I wanted to really talk freely about these things, because so many people are used to thinking in such simplistic terms. I can bind Satan. Well, no, you can't. If God wants Satan bound, there's Michael, who can literally see Satan, and if given the power by God, can bind Satan. In fact, he kicked him out of heaven. So in that sense, he was bound. He was bound to this earth, and he's not happy. Doesn't need you, because you can't see him. You don't even know where he's at. You don't even know when he's operating in your life, or who is operating in your life, or exactly what. So for us to speak as if we had empirical fact is once again the height of lunacy. I can say that demonic possession occurs. I cannot look at you and say, you are free from demonic oppression, or you are free from demonic possession. I don't know that. I cannot know that. Just like I cannot know when you are being possessed. Christ could know that. The apostles, with their sign gifts, we're given that ability for a short time to authenticate their message, could know that. But even as we see the book of Acts proceeding, they were losing those abilities. So I want us to begin with chapter 11, verse 1, and that's really where all we're going to discuss today. Is we're going to take the statement that this angel makes, We're going to look at it, and then we're going to see it at work in a previous passage of Daniel. We could have gone anywhere in the Bible. Any conflict. And if given enough data or information in the passage, we could see these aspects at work. Now, that doesn't mean that I can go out today and say, factually, this is happening in my life. Demonic forces are doing this. God's angelic forces are doing that on me. And I know this for an absolute fact. I can't do that. Because I have no way to determine or sense the non-empirical. And so it takes looking at the scriptures, because the scriptures tell us the spiritual warfare at work. It tells us who is evil and who is approved of by God. And we can then see through the lens of the scriptures how these forces are arrayed and how this plays out. So don't get it from the lesson and walk out in the world and say, and point your finger and say, aha, I know that you are, because you'd be an idiot. You don't know that. You don't even know that you are not possessed or possessed. And what we see in the Gospels are basically those demonic forces that were unrestrained and tearing at their victims. Thus, they were cast out. But how many were not so unrestrained? And Christ did not cast them out. Allowed them to continue their work. Or shouldn't Christ be? No, he shouldn't. That was not his mission. His mission is to let the wheat and the tares grow together and separate them out at judgment. Because the tares will prove themselves worthy of destruction. So as for me, and this is the angel speaking, so this is not Daniel's speech right here. This is the angel speaking. And he says, it's me. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him, is what it says in the ESV. And it's a little awkward because it's not quite what it's saying in the Hebrew. And it's interesting that the angel begins with Darius, because this is the only passage in this vision that deals with the Persians. So why would the angel say this? Because the angel is authenticating his message. He's telling Daniel something Daniel would have understood, would have had access to, would have lived through. So he goes back to Darius the Mede. And that is Darius the general who defeated Babylon and captured the city, Babylon. And thus, he became the suzerain under Cyrus, It was literally the Persian. So this angel has identified himself already as being the general of the angelic forces of the watching over the Persians. So he's talking about what he did. He can't talk about what he is doing with the Greeks because that's not his job. He's not with them. He's not over them. He can read out of the book that is written. Now, we don't have that book. That book's in heaven. See, we don't get access to all the books. We get access to the scripture, the Bible, and that's kind of like a shorthand overview of everything. We don't get access to the books of works. Imagine that's got to be a healthy big library. And we certainly don't get access to the book of life. Otherwise, we'd look ahead, see who's going to be good, who's going to make it. We'd be writing notes. Well done. But that's not how it works either. So the angel is authenticating his message. And the angel says he confirmed Darius. That's the Hebrew word hazach. And it's in the Hifil voice. And it means, I was there to, I'm the one that worked to strengthen and prove or provide Darius's strength. Now, Darius was not strong on his own. And we're going to see that here in a minute. So in other words, the angel gave Darius strength, not unlike Christ gave strength to Daniel. And we've talked about in previous lessons here. Now, it's kind of awkward here because in the ESV it says, and strengthened him. Strengthened there is a noun, and it is the Hebrew noun ma'az, and it means fortress or stronghold. And so the angel says, I became a stronghold to Darius. In other words, I surrounded him. I protected him. When he moved in a moving fortress. Because, and I want us to grasp that concept because that's how it works for all who are saved. You might be thinking, well, it's a leaky fortress because I'm certainly getting my butt kicked. Or I'm certainly going through a lot of tribulation. Or we're being harassed and numbers of us killed. And isn't that what Paul was complaining about in his epistles? Yet they will shine brighter than stars in heaven for their faithfulness as Christ worked through them. And yet they were guarded like a fortress in order to accomplish their mission. And this is what we're going to understand about spiritual warfare in this lesson. Because we believe or want to believe that we should be impenetrable, totally off limits, and that we can operate with impunity. Well, the problem is is that the mission is twofold. It's not only to protect you, but it is to mature you. And you only get matured in combat under fire. You can train all you want to. You make all the plans you want to. Those plans die with the first outbreak of hostilities. We have to be trained to release aspects of our old sinful worldview and to cling to Christ so that He can be that fortress. And He is that fortress, but He allows some of those slings and arrows to come through to mature us, to teach us, to edify us. And we're going to see this here in this one scene we're going to look at to understand how these spiritual forces are at work behind the scenes of reality. So we're going to turn to Daniel chapter 6. Now, we're not going to go in depth on this because we've already done that when we went through this passage the first time. And you might say, well, why didn't you cover it like this the first time? Because you wouldn't have understood it. If I was going to have to cover it from that perspective the first time, we would have had to jump all the way up to Daniel chapter 10. But you wouldn't have understood it, because it would have been out of context. We have to build up to that, and that is what maturity is. When you first read a passage of Scripture and you think, I got that, I know it inside and out, I can go on to something else because I got this cold. Well, you do. For what you understand about it, but you come back a few months, few years later, after extensive Bible study elsewhere, and you read that passage, and you go, I didn't know that was in there. Wow, I didn't know it did that. And suddenly, you understand that you didn't understand. That you had a tiny bit of knowledge. Now you got more knowledge. Years later, you come back and you got more. And you go, I am in awe. I was just ignorant. And this is the understanding I want us to have as we come to the Scripture. Well, I don't want to do that because then it's just too much work. Well, let's have the lost speak. And that's how the immature Christian acts. They want just enough to get by, just enough to make that C minus D plus, and I'll be okay because I'll be in heaven, and God will forget all that stuff. Except that's not how that works, just so you know. Yes, you do get to heaven. Yes, you do get to be in eternity, future, new heaven, new earth kind of thing. But where are you going to be? If you only study a little bit and understand a little bit, how can He use you? Because it's not the Matrix. He doesn't just tap you upside the head and dump the what required knowledge you need and send you on your way. That's not maturity. That's programming. God doesn't want little automatons. He gets accused of that all the time. That's exactly what He doesn't want. He wants you to think, to grasp, and to want to grow. And certainly He puts that desire in you and encourages you to do that. But you have a part in that too. Notice these two accounts are linked by the first year of Darius. That's why we went to Daniel chapter 6. Now, can you see the strengthening of Darius turning him into a fortress? I hope so. Now, you have to remember, Darius is a general. He's not a politician. We talked about that. Thus, he's used to giving commands, and yes, you have political intrigues in the army, and yes, there are politics, and but it's not the same as when you're dealing with non-military politicians. See, at some point, the general just says, just stop it, or execute him, I'm tired of it, or put him over in that unit and let them deal with him a while. See if he learns anything. Can't really quite do that in civilian society. And so at this stage, Darius is simply using the Babylonian administrative system to restore order, to collect taxes, and to promote internal harmony. Now, it's a common tactic. Alexander the Great used it. Roman generals used it. Generals previous to this used it. It's, you go into an area, you don't want to totally destroy the infrastructure and have to build it from the bottom up, because that's not why you're there. Most of the time in the ancient world, in the late Bronze Age and early Iron Age, you're doing these things, these wars of tribute. You're not there to destroy society, because the society is destroyed, it's not paying you duty. It's not giving you booty, it's not paying you taxes, and if you totally destroy it, then they're worthless to you. You want to get that province back to functionality as quickly as possible, to be as productive as possible, to pay you taxes as much as possible. And thus, you need people that know the system, that know the people. And that's what Darius did. I mean, it was a brilliant move. In fact, when we go to here, let's go to Daniel chapter 6. Darius had this system. We had three admin people under him, and under these three, he had the 120 satraps, or local provincial administrators, or might say 120 states if you're going to be putting it into Americanese. But Daniel so distinguished himself with his honesty and clarity that Darius was going to be putting him over everybody. Now, you can imagine that this little group, who'd been working together for a while before they were conquered. Remember, the conqueror is a different ethnic group, a different ethnicity. Yeah, we gotta honor him, but we don't gotta like him. And so we're gonna band together, and we're gonna reward ourselves for being faithful to each other and whoever bribes us. And we'll give Darius something or other. But they wouldn't be able to do that under Daniel, because Daniel knew them from a young teenager, remember? And Daniel had already saved their butts as a teenager in Daniel chapter 2, and they didn't like him. And so, what is really happening here? We could continue talking about it like this. But the fact that Darius is probably being moved upon by this angel, giving clarity of vision to see and understand Daniel's qualities. You can't simply promote yourself. You can, but that's really not how it works. It's behind the scenes. And so the demonic forces behind the scenes over the Persians, over the Babylonians, who are now under the Persians, and thus they were kind of drafted into that mix since they had experience, were already beginning to re-entrench themselves in their old ways and rebelling against Daniel, whom they hated. And we've talked about this through the book of Daniel. So Daniel is being tested. Once again, the lost are arrayed against him to bring him down. And the idea is floated that the only way to attack Daniel is through his faith. Now, if that doesn't come out of a demonic mouth, I don't know what does. And he doesn't sin in the fact that he doesn't cheat, he doesn't lie, he doesn't steal. So he's not like us. We can't get him on any of that stuff. And we certainly don't want to be accusing each other because we're all guilty of that stuff. So the only thing that we can accuse Daniel of is, yep, his faithfulness. This is why Peter is able to write, you will be persecuted for your faithfulness. It is better to suffer for being faithful than as a sinner. Do not do evil. Do not do wrong so that they can rightly accuse you. Don't do that. It's so easy for them to do that because we're all so fallible. We need those angelic fortresses around us to keep us from doing those things. Because it's that sin that so easily besets us, that destroys our testimony. And thus, Daniel could have been tempted to adopt their ways, becoming one of the system to steal from the conquerors. Except God requires honesty, and Daniel's an old gaffer now, and he's been doing this for so many years. And he's been strengthened over and over and over again that this is not tempting him. Let's turn to 1 Peter 4, verses 3 and 4. And most of our scriptures today will come out of 1 Peter chapter 4. Well, the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you. But they will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. That's why when you get together with family, they're shocked that you don't act like they do. And don't talk like you used to talk. And don't do the things you used to. And don't laugh at the jokes and use the same language and do all that. And they're surprised when you don't join them in these things. It doesn't have to be complete debauchery. It can just be the usual. Then they turn and attack you. Or if not you, then the one who is encouraging you not to do those things. That you are a changed person. Whether it be Christ, whether it be these angelic forces working on you, that are over you, that are trying to turn you, strengthen you, and become the fortress around you. Remember, that's why they attacked Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because they were strengthening Daniel, so let's take them out of the picture. So these demonic forces work through lost people against God's people. Now, I'm not saying that demonic forces cannot use natural forces. They can. And we see this in Job chapter 1 and 2. Tornado comes through. Lightning comes through. It's just... it can be done with permission. But that's not really what we're looking at today. And that's not what the angel was talking about. He was talking about the demonic and angelic forces working through people. So this is exactly what we're looking at. Unless the Bible clearly tells us what is occurring behind the scenes, we do not know. We are totally dependent, and we certainly cannot look out into what's going on around us. That hurricane is demonic. We pray God that he just stop it in its tracks. Well, that may not be the case, or it may be the case. I don't know, and you don't know, unless God actually says. So, that is a fool's discussion. Because we don't know unless God literally tells us. But these demonic forces, they're working through lost people. This entire political bureaucracy becomes united against Daniel. And guess what? They're united against Darius too, because they think Darius an idiot. And he is. Because he's got to learn a lesson. That leaky fortress thing. And so Darius will simply be a tool motivated by pride and lust for control through an empty symbolic gesture that actually robs him of control. Now notice, they say we can only attack Daniel through his religion, therefore, hey Darius, we have this plan for you. We want to elevate you. You are so great and you have so good for us that we want for the next 30 days, the next lunar month, no one pray to anything, anyone except you. Pay homage to you, to worship you, because you are so great for us. And Darius is going, I like that. Okay. You just conquered this people, and they're telling you how great you are. You should have warning bells going off everywhere. You should be asking yourself, what are they stealing? How much more are they going to steal? Where are they putting it? And are they going to assassinate me? Should have been thinking that. Politicians, that's how they think. And there's a reason for that. Or if they're smart politicians. And so, Darius makes his rule. He signs it. And the moment he signs it and puts his seal on it, he loses control. Because they warn him, this will be a law under the Medes and the Persians and cannot be undone. And he goes, yep, I like it. And you like it until suddenly you don't like it. But it cannot be undone. So the moment he makes that edict for control, he loses control. That is the deal Satan always makes, as do his demonic forces. The moment you make a deal for control, you forfeit control. Absolutely. You got nothing. You are now a slave. And he was a slave to that law. He was a slave to those demonic forces, and he was a slave to the bureaucracy he was supposed to be controlling. He lost absolute control in this situation. So Darius succumbs, and he signs it. Notice, everyone is personally responsible for their choices. Yes, this bureaucracy was lost and was enslaved to the demonic forces. They could only choose demonic means. But once again, all those influences, they did not know. They could only operate on their perception of understanding. And thus, with the limited knowledge they have, they, quote unquote, chose to do this evil. Thus, they were responsible. It's what you decide to do that condemns you or elevates you. So once the edict was signed, Daniel was tempted to not do it. Now, it might not have been tempted very long. Might have said, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm an old guy. I don't want to die like that. Oh, well. So he goes, and he prays where he can be seen. Not out in the street corner. He's not an idiot. But he knows they're spying on him. And so he goes to a room that looks out and he can be observed, and he's observed praying. And he knows he's being observed praying. But these angelic spiritual forces gave Daniel strength to be a fortress, to remain true, even though not specifically mentioned in the text. This is a logical inference from the angel's previous elucidation with Daniel. Let's go back to 1 Peter and drop down to verse 12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. For if you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the spirit of glory and of God rests on you. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, or an evildoer, or even a meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. And this is exactly what Daniel was doing. He was glorifying God. As Peter and John told the Sanhedrin in the book of Acts, chapter 4, when they were beaten and told not to preach the name of Christ again, Peter says, well, you know, as much as we'd want to obey you, you yourself have to decide what's right. Is it better for us to obey God or to obey you? Now, Peter before Pentecost would never have been able to say that. He couldn't even have put that thought into action. He'd have just stood up and said, heck with all you guys, I'm going to do it anyway. But here, he actually puts an argument to them, like Christ would have, that they can't answer because the answer would condemn them. Of course, they're the Sanhedrin. We have to do what God tells us to do. See, Peter and John, the angelic forces around them becoming a fortress for them, and yet they were training them, and they were strengthened, given strength, Christ's strength through them. And look at how much Peter had changed and matured. And look at Daniel is maturing. He's being matured to receive this vision and to find peace, even though he is being attacked. Now, as before, Daniel had no expectation that God was going to protect him. In other words, Daniel did not take this action expecting no consequences. Well, I got to spend the night in a hole. Oh, well. Nah, he had every expectation that he was going to go in that lion's den and die. Horribly. He had no expectation for anything else. In fact, if you go to Daniel chapter 3, starting in verse 16, you'll see that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, to use their Babylonian names, did exactly the same thing. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. In other words, we have no need to think this over. This is not a complex answer. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning furnace of fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. In other words, our God can do this. He may choose not to. I don't know what his plans are right now. Once again, they were not making a decision that didn't have any consequence for them. It had absolute consequences for them as far as they understood. They were going to go in that furnace and burn. In fact, people who threw them into that furnace burned. This was their expectation. This was Daniel's expectation. And so, the king, being the king, was no longer king, commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve, continually deliver you, because, obviously, I can't. Because I have no control. I forfeited that because I was an idiot. That's what the lost are. That's what the lost do. They think they have control. They think they have power. They think they got you. And all they got is the body. And if they destroy the body, your soul is immediately with God. And so he was cast into the den of lions. the bureaucracy that accused him, that accused Daniel to Darius, the Hasatan, which is really what Satan means. Hasatan is the accuser, the one who makes accusation, and that's what the bureaucracy was doing. They were acting like their father, the devil, accusing. And yet, to no avail. So he was bound, Darius was bound by his edict, or faced questioning about his competence by Cyrus. In other words, he was going to be guilty of faithlessness. Remember, he is a suzerain. He's a Median. He is the partnership with the Persians, but it's the junior partner. And in fact, after he dies a year and a half or so after this event, he's not replaced. Cyrus just takes it under his own command. In other words, he did it to keep peace in his coalition. So Darius, weak in character, which is a characteristic of sin, throws a knowingly innocent man to the lions. Herein is the work. Herein was the is where the angel begins his work on Darius. Right here. And we see this process. In verse 17 and 18. Well, in verse 18, then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions, no women, no nothing. He spent the night awake. I don't think he was in absolute worry. Yes, he was afraid for Daniel because he didn't know better. But then Daniel had no expectations. And yet, he had no peace in his soul. He was in crisis. He was wrestling, and the demonic forces were working on him. But guess what? This angel was working also. And giving him faith. See, we're talking about giving strength. That's what we're talking about. Giving him faith. And being a fortress around him so the demonic onslaught would not overwhelm him and drive him to despair. This is This is Darius's come to Jesus moment, I believe. Then at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. And as he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried, Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God. Notice his change in tone. Living God. Has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lion? And he waits because he has no expectation of hearing anything. And Daniel had no expectation that he would be alive to say anything. See, these men did not make their decisions believing there'd be no consequences. They had every expectation of negative consequences. And yet, Daniel speaks. O king, live forever. Notice, no rebellion, no hatred, no betrayal. God works through authority. Daniel does not depend upon Darius. He does not depend on Cyrus. He depends upon God. And if God takes him home, then God takes him home. And if God keeps him here, then God keeps him here. It is always to God. Thus he is respectful to the king because God hates rebellion. My God sent his angel. Wonder which one that was. And shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him and also before you. I have done no harm. And the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. And no harm was found on him because he trusted God. Now, it's not say that if you were here or you were in a similar situation that you would have the same outcome. You can't be doing that. That's not how to understand this scripture. I hear these kinds of sermons all the time, and I'm asked, do you not ever read the Bible? Just because Daniel doesn't mean you. His mission is different from yours. If God had not protected Daniel, he would have been in paradise, like Lazarus in Luke 16. Now, I don't think Daniel would mind that. Even with the bumpy start. But Darius would not have been saved. The point here is to save Darius. To show how God works even among Gentiles. And that's how the Jews should be behaving. But they weren't. They're behaving like the Jews in the book of Esther. Plotting and thinking about being killed and killing. Not about praying and following Daniel's example and trusting in God. See, God's about building character. It's never about magic, and it certainly is not about blind faith, which is really more an element of satanic believism than anything else. Because faith is not blind. Faith is strengthening from God via the Spirit based on his word. See, if you're not studying the Bible and you're acting on faith, then yeah, that's blind faith. That's just plain stupid. That's jumping off the cliff and saying, God, catch me. And I think Satan tried to get Christ to do that, and Christ said, what, are you an idiot? Is that how God works? And you go back and read that book again. God did not have the angel simply give Darius strength, which would have been ineffective, as he was lost. Darius came under both demonic and angelic influence during that night Daniel was in the lion's den. But God works through our crisis, bringing one to understanding of him. Nowhere in Scripture is salvation simply a magic one-swish moment. It is a born from above. It is a birth. Birth. From above. And a birth is nearly always traumatic for the baby. And it's not real pleasant for the mom. And being a nurse for 30 years, yes, I've seen quite a few births. I believe Darius reached his salvation moment when he knew Daniel had been kept safe by God. And he called him the living God. That's believism right there. And that's why Daniel lived, is so Darius could be saved. The ferociousness of the lions, though, was confirmed by the destruction of the two other administrators and the few satraps that remained in Babylon. Now, though the whole 120 were in it, I don't think they all just came to Babylon to watch. They had their own provinces to run and stuff. I think the few in the area came and spoke for the majority of them. That would be more efficient and very regimented as Satan is. That would certainly be more according to his line of reasoning. But notice, since Daniel survived the sentence, the law was ineffective. The law was null and void on Daniel. So he could be taken out of the lion's den. It said you'd be thrown in there. It didn't say you had to be kept there till you died. So he followed the rule of the law. And the rule of the law says, well, there's another rule. That if you make a king an idiot, he gets to, well, I guess he doesn't like you no more. And he regained control. And he said, throw them in. And their families. I'll eliminate this hotbed of conspiracy and corruption. And the pit that they dug for others, they themselves fell into. Which the writer of Proverbs talks about several times. And it's also a lesson to Satan. Turn to Matthew 8:29. And behold, they cried, what have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? Of course, this was Legion of demons. In the demoniac who was tearing at himself, and among other things. And Christ, they had to obey Christ. Christ says, what do you guys call yourself? We call ourselves a lot. Because that's really what legion means, many. So they just said, we're a group. Well, guess what? And they all cry out because they knew what was coming. They'd broken the rules. They were going to go be chained in the abyssos. And he called out to him. They recognized whom he was. They see his spiritual essence. He said, if you come here to torment us before the time, in other words, there is the time coming. They know the judgment time's coming. They're trying their hardest to prevent it, but they know it's coming. And they're asking, are you here to take care of us before that time? Because we hope so. We hope so. Because then you would be unrighteous. And no judgment. And Christ says, no. That's not what I'm doing. So they said, well, send us into the pigs. Go. Of course, there were no more in control in the pigs than they were in the person. And so the pigs were off the cliff. And I suppose the demons were still chained in Tartar or in the abyssus. Though scripture doesn't really tell us that, I don't think they were allowed to go free and just torment and torment. Then the king writes the note to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell on the earth. People are to tremble in fear before the God of Daniel, for he is a living God, enduring forever. This is a testimony of a saved person. When this spiritual warfare continues, it's not about who wins. Now, while the spiritual warfare continues, it's not about who wins the struggle. Because God is not in a battle for his life. He's not in a battle for his existence. He's God. And as we just read in Matthew, they recognized Christ was Son of God. So it's not like, hey, let's gang up on him. He's one. We're many. It's like, that'd be foolish talk right there, just so you know. But the angelic forces under God's direction simply prevent the demonic forces from becoming completely self-destructive. Turn to Jude verses 6 and 7. And the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. And we'll just leave it at verse 6. Yet God slowly pulls back his restraining forces so man can experience the full impact of a world without God. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 through 12. And the Bible records the victory always belongs to God because God. Christ endured these same spiritual forces at work on himself when he came in the flesh, and they believed they won when they killed him, only to discover that they lost. They were the instruments of securing their own destruction and our salvation. Now we are to humble ourselves under God, who does what is right by us and for us, knowing he cares for us. Thus we will not be ashamed on that day. Are we acting that way? Do we really believe that? We should. But you know, most of us do not. You can see it. Whether people try to hedge their bets. Well, I don't want to alienate people. I don't want to appear unreasonable. God knows my true intent in my heart. He'll understand. Yeah, there'll be a lot of understanding at the judgment seat. I understand that part. And it's not going to be as understanding as you're thinking understanding. It's going to be understanding as God thinks is understanding. That's why we study the scriptures, to learn these lessons, so we will not need to be ashamed when we stand before him in that day. Thank you.